way. And that's what I think we see happening with Jews and non-Jews. And the last thing I'll just add is that, interestingly, when you go to demonstrations, protests largely of Palestinians and Arabs and Muslims against the Israeli regime's crimes in Gaza, what you see is a tremendous openness on the part of that population to Jews in particular who are willing to stand with them. There's no notion of hostility. There's no notion of interreligious conflict. What there is a tremendous appreciation for the common humanity that we express when we stand with Palestinians in this way.
We've been speaking with Michael Letwin. He's a New York City public defender and former president of the Association of Legal Aid Attorneys and co-founder of Jews for Palestinian Right of Return. Oh, where can people see this petition?
The petition is posted on change.org, and unfortunately, there's not a simple link for that. But if you go to JFPROR at WordPress, or if you go to Jews for Palestinian Right of Return on Facebook, you'll find the link very easily.
All right. I want to thank you very much for joining us on Flashpoints.
Thanks for having us.
All right, bye-bye now.
And Dennis Bernstein's out of Brooklyn. And if you go to the Jews for Palestinian Right of Return Facebook page, you can like Ellen Pape, Max Blumenthal, Hedy Epstein, Rabbi Lynn Gottlieb, Miko Pelid, David Zirin, Michael Ratner, Anna Balzer, which I just did. Okay, opinions of those of the speakers, not necessarily shared. I'll be back tomorrow, and hopefully I'll have something from Robert Perry about the Ukraine mess that I was speaking of and alternate possibilities. Thanks for listening. It's time for the Labor Hour.
jobs are turning black. Jobs are gone, they ain't coming back. They're overseas. Might as well close the store. They used to call us working class, but we're just not working anymore. We're not a working. We're not a working.
Hello, folks. Welcome to another edition of the World Labor Hour, brought to you on the air by listener-supported community radio station WEFT, broadcasting from downtown Champaign, Illinois. The views and opinions expressed here are those of speakers and do not necessarily represent those of the station manager, board of directors, or of Prairie Air Incorporated. Now, here's Bob with some underwriting announcements.
Yeah, thanks, Dave. This hour programming is brought to you in part by Central Illinois Jobs with Justice, a coalition of union and community groups working for economic justice and workers' rights. Central Illinois Jobs with Justice holds regular meetings on the third Saturday of every month. And for more information or for the unemployed and underemployed helpline, give them a call at 217-328-2295. And also, the World Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois. And programming on the World Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and by the Illinois Education Association Union. The Illinois Education Association's mission is to effect excellence and equity in public education and to be the advocacy organization for all public education employees. Programming on the World Labor Hour is supported in part by listeners at WEFT and Decatur attorney Bill Faber, who believes that the mission of the law is the safety of the people. Bill Faber proudly supports the World Labor Hour. And the Graduate Employees Organization Union, GEO, at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign strives to not only democratically represent graduate employees, but also to give solidarity and support to other unions, organizations, and workers engaged in the struggle for social justice both on and off campus. The GEO is proud to support the World Labor Hour on WEFT Community Radio.
Okay, thank you, Bob. And so we got a special co-host in the station today, Jim Iman. Jim, welcome back to the Labor Hour.
Oh, thanks, Dave. Always a pleasure.
Yeah.
You've got some courage getting me back on the air.
But oh, no courage, merely a pleasure. And we got also our anonymous friend and sit-in sort of host here, and we won't name his name at this point. So anyway, one of these days, though, I think he will finally maybe want to make a statement or two at least, or maybe come on with an actual labor-related topic to talk about. So, but no hurry there. Anyway, Bob, you got some news stories?
Yeah, I got several things here, Dave. Fast food workers are preparing to escalate their wage demands. Fast food workers say they're prepared to escalate their campaign for higher wages and union representation, starting with a national convention in suburban Chicago, where more than 1,000 workers will discuss the future of the effort that has spread to dozens of cities in less than 2 years. About 1,300 workers are scheduled to attend sessions Friday and Saturday, yesterday and today, at an expo center in Villa Park, Illinois, where they'll be asked to do whatever it takes to win $15 an hour wages and a union, said Kendall Fells, organizing director of the national effort and a representative of the Service Employees International Union, SEIU. The union has been providing financial and organizational support to the fast food protests that began in late 2012 in New York City and have included day-long strikes and a protest outside this year's McDonald's Corporation shareholder meeting that resulted in more than 130 arrests. We want to talk about building leadership, power, and doing whatever it takes depending on what city they're in and what the movement calls for, said Fells, adding that the ramped-up actions will be more high-profile and could include everything from civil disobedience to intensified efforts to organize workers. Here's a quote from a lady named Sherry Desline. She's a 27-year-old single mother from Charleston, South Carolina. She says, I personally think we need to get more workers involved and shut these businesses down until they listen to us. She's been working at a McDonald's there for 10 years and makes $7.35 an hour. Mm. Desline said she and her four girls live with her mother, but the family still has difficulty paying utilities and the mortgage while providing for her children. She said she's not been to see a doctor in 2 years and does not get paid if she stays home sick. So they're looking for that livable wage of $15 an hour. But we'll see what comes out of this meeting up there in Chicago, 1,300 workers from around the country getting together.
Oh, that's great.
Try and escalate this campaign a little bit.
Indeed. Well, the Social Security Administration is rapidly implementing a critically flawed and poorly understood series of office closings and service reductions at exactly the same time as more and more Americans rely on the Social Security system. These office closings and service reductions are accompanied by a national campaign to try to convince the public that they should utilize the Internet to do their Social Security business. With more demand on the system, it's critical the Social Security Administration retain the staffing and infrastructure to ensure world-class service for all Americans who have earned their Social Security benefits. There are millions of Americans who do not have access to computers and printers, who do not trust the security of online services, who are not proficient using the Internet, who do not fully comprehend the many nuances of Social Security, or who simply want questions answered by a trained Social Security Administration employee. It is not the Social Security Administration's mission to deny those Americans the benefits and services they have been promised. These customers demand face-to-face service with a trained Social Security expert to assist them in navigating the complexities of the Social Security programs. Millions of Americans depend on trained Social Security employees to administer their earned retirement, survivor, and disability benefits. Millions more depend on the income security provided through the Supplemental Security Income Program. And we have a right to the services and benefits promised under the law with a lifetime of hard work. And we, the people, support an expansion of direct face-to-face and telephone services and the strengthening of the Social Security system that all Americans have depended on for 79 years and will count on for generations to come. Of course, this is all part of the, I think, backdoor attempts to try to privatize Social Security. Basically what they've been, you know, this whole thing going on with the Veterans Administration, these scandals and stuff they're talking about, trying to convince the American people that, the Veterans Administration is no good because it's public. And I think it's kind of a similar backdoor thing they're trying to do with Social Security here, it seems.
Yep. I got another story here. This kind of concerns railway people. So this is about the BNSF. It says, for decades, the U.S. railroad industry has successfully shed labor costs by shifting to smaller and smaller operating crews. Now it's on the verge of what was once an unthinkable victory, single-member crews, even on dangerous oil trains. It says, a tentative agreement reached by Burlington Northern Santa Fe, BNSF Railway, and the Transportation Division of the Sheet Metal, Air, Rail, and Transportation Smart Union would allow a single engineer to operate most of the company's routes. It would mark a dramatic change to a labor contract that covers about 3,000 workers, or 60% of the BNSF system. It's not just bad news for workers. The contract has major safety implications, especially amid North America's dangerous and sometimes deadly crude by rail boom. Last year's Bakken's shale oil train derailment and explosion up there in Quebec, Canada, killed 47 people, brought increased scrutiny to to oil trains. In response, Canadian regulators outlawed one-person crews on trains carrying hazardous materials. A single engineer was in charge of that ill-fated train. Although it was unmanned when it rolled into the town center, I believe he put the automatic brakes on and got out of the locomotive to check on something, and the train took off on its own, went right into the center of town and blew up and killed 47 people.
Oh, wow.
Anyway, they're trying to say that, you know, single engineer trains would be permitted on the BNSF route, you know. Says here, someone says, no one would permit an airliner to fly with just one pilot, even though they can fly themselves. They say trains, which cannot operate themselves, should be no different. So serious safety concerns if they push this through and get these single engineer trains running around this country.
Well, Jim, you're a retired railroad worker, so what's your take on this?
Well, first of all, the United Transportation Union is a scabby-ass union to begin with. When they came together, they united all the brotherhoods except for one, the Switchman's Union of North America, which was the only Democratic craft in the country. They elected everything from local reps to regional reps to national reps. They were excluded. They weren't at the original convention. The credentials committee denied them access. At that time, we had a five-man crew. Wow. A fireman, an engineer, a head man, a conductor, and a rear brakeman.
Right.
And a caboose.
Right. They took caboose off of them trains years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah, you rarely see cabooses anymore.
Well, you don't see them.
Never, yeah.
And
saves them a little bit of money.
Yeah.
It saves them money, but immediately, by taking the caboose away, their safety went down enormously.
Right.
So the more the crew you remove, the less safe it is.
Right.
It's automatic.
Right. Yeah.
The year they pulled the cabooses, the wife of the president of the United Transportation Union did a painting for the yearly calendar of the little red caboose. God, what is this? This was like shoving it in everybody's face. It's like, we got to remember it, you know? I mean, so anyway, what they want to do is get rid of all crews and operate them manually, you know, like a model railroad. And a terrorist's greatest gift.
Right.
Yeah, says here, that's a good thought. Yeah.
Says here, there's no federal law in the books that requires two-person rail crews for shipments of dangerous goods. The Federal Railway Administration, FRA, is expected to issue a proposed rule on the subject by the end of the year. But workers worry that without contract guarantees and no federal protections in place, BNSF will make the move, the cost-cutting shift to one-person crews. So,
man,
see what happens with that.
Well, this story I've got is from Dr. Ann Sheets, who's with the Illinois Single Payer Coalition based in Chicago. This year, coming up, I think, here real soon, within a matter of days or weeks, is the 49th anniversary of Medicare. And between now and this time next year, approaching the 50th year anniversary, there's going to be a lot of publicity generated just about, you know, Medicare in general. And she kind of produced this thing, Medicare, the Good, the Bad, in the future, and she mentions Medicare the Good provides health insurance for more than 50 million American seniors and people with disabilities, has reduced poverty among older people, thus enhancing the financial security of all generations and their families. Compared to private insurance, traditional Medicare has very low overhead, much less hassle, and is more economical. Enrollees with traditional Medicare have almost complete choice of doctors, hospitals, and other providers. And then Medicare the Bad, at this point, does not cover all the care people need. Cost sharing is too high. Is being increasingly privatized through HMOs, Medicare Advantage programs, that have high overhead, restricted networks of providers, high cost sharing for sick people, and through Part D plans that also have high overhead as well as limited formularies. And Medicare the Future, don't cut, don't privatize, no vouchers, don't raise the eligibility age. Include the drug benefit and regular Medicare and allow Medicare to negotiate drug prices, which they're prohibited under law from doing. Decrease deductibles and copays, don't increase them. Improve and expand it so that it covers 100% of all necessary care for every person living in the U.S. from birth to death, which is what exists in all civilized countries in the world. And ultimately, this is the only way to save Medicare. So that's, again, from Dr. Ann Sheets of the Illinois Single Payer Coalition. Okay, we're going to take a quick music break here, and then we're going to be right back to talk with Jim Eyman about what's been going on in the Ukraine. So you're listening to the World Labor Hour on Listener Supported Community Radio Station WFT in Champaign, Illinois. Stay tuned.
Program. A religious fanatic posts footage of an interfaith service project. A group of teenage boys watches a video of a father playing catch with his son. An adult film star paints thumbnail portraits of elderly couples fully clothed and smiling. A record executive records a demo of his apology. A policeman makes reverse 911 calls, instructing residents to take to the streets. A patriarch reports for duty. She's wearing an orange jumpsuit and holding a picket sign. She's ashamed of her birthplace, but retreat is not an option.
Women and children, frontline, log on, tune in, stand and be counted, wounded. Station in the belly of the vulture, watch your back, there's no civilians, women, children, frontline, listen. Consider this a distant early warning. The fire's imminent, pollution gathering, dust particles funneling through smokestacks, airwaves, bandwidth, disinformation too fed. Check the labels, delete the virus, alert the masses.
Butterfly wing crosswinds send black hawks toward hurricane survivors. Roses sprout from empty lots and sidewalk cracks. Pacifist guerrillas move undetected through concrete jungles. New forms are beginning to take shape. Once occupied minds are activating. People are waking up. The insurgency is alive and well.
Rise of the robot, portrait of the new American insurgent. Rattle and shake the foundations of the world order. Assembly line, consent, resist, refuse, inform, create, direct, love once to the trenches. Suit up for trouble into fortresses.
Okay, that was the Flowbots, and we're back here on the World Labor Hour. Some public service announcements. Bob?
Yeah, Dave, I wanted to mention we had three great guests on last week, and they were talking about the Interdependent Film Festival, Women Making Movies, co-sponsored by the Urbana-Champaign Independent Media Center and the School for Designing a Society. It says 3 days and six films. The schedule starts Thursday, July 31st this week, 6 p.m. They have an Interdependent Film Festival social, and then films start at 7 o'clock on Thursday. They have films on Friday and Saturday, featuring films by Susan Parenti, Nina Paley, Carol Huang, and several others. Mm-hmm. Great stuff all happening at the UCIMC over there, the old post office in downtown Urbana.
Great.
So
okay.
Check it out. You can get tickets online at Brown Paper Tickets. So check it out on Facebook or whatnot.
And you had something also from Labor Notes?
Yeah, you were mentioning we'll have some guests on here from Labor Notes, and you went to the Labor Notes conference, and there was a real interesting article on there a couple weeks ago titled Facebook Organizing Legal Do's and Don'ts. Talks about what you can and can't do on Facebook, what you could be held liable for saying, and some recommendations as to what you can say and stuff like that.
Okay.
Talks about the NLRA, the National Labor Relations Act, and how it affects you if you're working in private industry, government industry, and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
So the web address for that is just go to labornotes.org/2014/07. And Facebook-organizing-legal do's and don'ts. And there's some worthwhile information in there for everybody to read about if they're doing any kind of organizing and social media these days.
Okay. Okay, Progressive Fest, Getting Out the Vote and Beyond, Organizing for Participatory Democracy. That's next Saturday, August 2nd, from 2:30 to 5:30 at the Champaign Public Library, rooms Robeson Rooms A and B. And it's going to be a discussion on why elections matter and why simply voting is not enough. And it's also going to be some power training for getting out progressive voters. There'll be refreshments and a social. And this is hosted by the Central Illinois Progressive Democrats of America, as well as Central Illinois Jobs and Justice and some other organizations. So that's next Saturday, August 2nd, 2:30 to 5:30 at the Champaign Park Library Rooms, Robeson Rooms A and B. Tune in today for another sports show at 104.5 FM WRFU with host, fellow worker Neil Parthen. And you can check that every Saturday from 2 to 3 o'clock, and also every Sunday from 4 to 5, check out Labor's World View TV on Comcast Channel 6 at Urbana Public Television. You can also access it live at www.urbanapublictelevision.org. Okay, so, Jim, there's been a lot going on in the Ukraine lately. What's your take on it?
May I address one question about service workers.
Workers, okay.
Mm-hmm. If you add labor productivity onto the amount of inflation on the basis of the 1965 minimum wage, they should be making $22.50. And I think anything less than that is not acceptable.
Yeah, I've seen the same figures, you know, based on productivity.
Yeah, mm-hmm. So getting back to the Ukraine, the breaking news in the Ukraine right now is that British investigative journalist Graham Phillips,
that's right. Okay.
Graham Phillips has just been released. He was in custody for almost 4 days, 3.5 days or something, and they expelled him from the country, took his car, took his the loft or the flat that he owns.
Hmm. Flak jacket.
And all of his money and his flak jacket.
Mm-hmm. So now, this was done by the Ukrainian authorities?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Kiev.
Okay. The one that has fascists in the cabinet?
Well, they're pretty much it.
Yeah.
I mean, except the cabinet is now dissolved.
Okay.
Ugansk, that toady that was appointed by... the U.S. State Department, essentially,
yeah.
Victoria Nuland,
mm-hmm.
says, "Oh, this is the best guy."
Mm-hmm.
Surprise! 2 weeks later, he was installed. You know,
yep.
Like there's no conspiracy theory involved in here. It's so patently obvious what went on.
Yeah, you know, Victoria Nuland, who's Assistant Secretary of State in the State Department, admitted that they've spent the State Department, the U.S. State Department, has spent $5 billion of our tax money over the last decade or so trying to mold Ukraine into what they would like it to be. And little background. This, you know, there was this all these demonstrations that turned very violent starting the end of last year and the beginning of this, that basically forced the government to collapse. I mean, this was against a democratically elected government that was due for another election in 2015. You want to talk about that a little bit, just to give a background a little bit?
Sure.
Because we're not getting this in the U.S. corporate media, not accurately anyway.
Right. Well, the capitalist media either lies or they tell half-truths.
Mm-hmm.
They never give you the facts. This is why RT on questions outside of Russia is extremely good.
That's RT television?
Yes,
yeah.
RT and cable.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to have a
satellite or cable
expensive
to get it.
Cable package
right.
in order to get it.
But you can get it on the internet, too. You know, you can go to RT.
Yeah, capital R, capital T,
mm-hmm.
.com,
mm-hmm.
and you can get it. Thank you for pointing that out, Dave. We have to, really to understand what's going on in the Ukraine, I think we have to go back to World War II. This guy Bandera, who was a out-and-out Nazi, was the first Ukrainian nationalist. Now, at all demonstrations, they have a big picture of Bandera that they carry around.
Hmm.
Okay, the real Ukrainian nationalist. And he was a supporter of the Third Reich. And so you've got that part. But until the Ukraine was made a Soviet Socialist Republic. It had never been an independent country. Mm. It was always broken up either by the
Austrian-Hungarians or the
Austrian-Hungarian Empire and the Russian Tsars, or
Poland,
too, Poland, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly. So you have all these different religions, you know, everything from Orthodox to Roman Catholic, and you've got...
and there was a sizable Jewish population in Ukraine before World War II, right?
Right. Extremely large, yes.
Mm-hmm.
So what's been going on is that, you know, we are claiming, the U.S. is claiming, as does Kiev, that the separatists, they call them, the People's Republic of Donetsk and Lugansk, are terrorists. So this gives them the right to bomb them out of existence, which has been going on. It's never reported in the capitalist media. Only on RT and to some extent Al Jazeera and to some extent France 24, as far as TV stations are concerned. They've shot down, so they have some sophisticated surface-to-air missiles, which they claim they stole from Kiev. Kiev says they were given by the Russians. I don't know the answer to that, but I'm glad they've got them.
For self-defense, yeah.
Well, yeah, for self-defense purposes. Because there's 250,000 refugees that got out of the country because of this bombing. They're using phosphorus...
white phosphorus bombs?
White phosphorus fire bombs.
Okay.
Yeah.
This might be our guest calling in from New York City. We'll take this call. Hello, WFT, you're on the air.
Hi, good morning. My name is Dan Zaleski, and I'm a member of the Workers' Power Group.
Okay, Dan, well, welcome to the World Labor Hour, and just want to tell the listeners that I met one of your comrades up in Chicago at Labor Notes back in April, and wanted to get you on the air and stuff. And so why don't you just start off by talking about, maybe yourself, if you think it's appropriate, and about workers' power.
Sure. I'm an activist, Philadelphia area, labor, social issues, education. I was a founding member of the Workers' Power Group back in 2009 when we drafted and approved our program, which is our basis for organization and unity, and sort of outlines our aims, our principles, strategy, and the day-to-day tactics we use to achieve those goals and achieve that strategy. And, after that, we established our sympathies with an organization called the League for the Fifth International. And since then, we've been, producing pamphlets, books, articles, being involved in activism, various issues, and doing our best, essentially, to build the organization.
Okay, so what are some of the principles of your organization?
Principally speaking, we fight for socialist society, for the empowerment of the working class and the oppressed under capitalism, both in the United States and internationally. And we attempt to link up, as I said just previously, what we do on a day-to-day basis to the attainment of this aim, for independence of the working class,
mm-hmm.
From the parties of the capitalist class, from organizations that are outside of the class, of the working class, and for the program, essentially, for the attainment of their own class power and for a socialist society.
Okay. So tell me about what you've been doing in the recent past as far as your organization's activities and stuff.
We're quite a small organization, so... Mm-hmm. A lot of what we do boils down to producing ideas, mm-hmm. arguments for distribution online and in physical form. Sort of a key aspect of what we do is to try to intervene as much as we can and I said, you know, various struggles that take place in the areas in which we live, and we bring sort of our message to those actions and sort of our ideas, our critiques of others within the within the movement, and sort of our perspectives for how to make them successful, and as well as intervening in sort of national or some conferences or meetings, you know, of significant importance. Like, so, for example, the Labor Notes Conference, mm-hmm. which is a quite important conference of trade unionists, rank-and-file trade unionists, and so forth. And so we went with sort of our message. You know, we distributed leaflets and literature, and it was essentially also a resolution, actually, for sort of a tactical platform of ours, which is for independent fighting workers' party of the Democrats, and in fact all the parties of the capitalist class. And so that's essentially how we, as a small group, try to make an impact when and where we can.
Mm-hmm. So I guess if you, as far as the future and stuff, are you you have any plans as far as basically trying to maybe run some candidates for local office in your area or other areas where there's you know, people involved in your organization?
No.
Okay.
That's a call, right? Move.
Not enough resources, and there are other organizations that are running that we would, in this instance, because of our small size and lack of relative, how would you put it, influence in the working class.
Mm-hmm.
We have tactics essentially to try to get ourselves more out there, and we did that previously in November by calling for, we critically supported votes for Jump Swan and Socialist Alternative in Seattle, as well as Ty Moore in Minneapolis. So we use that sort of tactically to insert ourselves in this kind of process, even when we can't stand independently of our own. But we believe that by sort of, you know, calling on the working class to critically support these organizations in the election, allows the working class sort of, allows for us to have sort of a dialogue with the working class to get our name and positions out there a bit more. So that's another aspect of our work.
Okay.
My friend, this is Jim Iman. I've been a lifelong socialist myself. I'm 71, so it goes back quite a ways. I joined the Young Socialist Alliance when I was 17 years old, and then the Fair Play for Cuba Committee. I've been down the road quite a few miles. I think the last chance we had to really build a labor party in this country was in the 1930s, when John L. Lewis was a household name. Nobody even remembers it anymore.
Sure.
And both the Socialist Workers' Party and the Communist Party were working, and others, even the Socialist Party, were all trying to convince him, you know, to break with the Democratic Party. But, of course, FDR bought him off with this, that, and the other thing, you know, the Wagner Labor Act and, you know, things that labor never had. So it was effective that way. But it just seems, I still believe in electoral politics, but it's getting more and more difficult to get on the ballot and certainly get a third party on the ballot. And the debates are no longer run by the League of Women Voters, they're run by a corporation, so no third party is ever going to be in a presidential debate. So how does your organization stand on this, and what do you think the working class can do to be as an independent political entity? Thanks.
Sure. Electoral politics are sort of a means to an end.
Mm-hmm.
At least that's how Workers' Power sees it.
Uh-huh.
You know, we're a revolutionary organization. We believe in revolution as the only way to resolve the contradictions and exploitation as a result of the capitalist system worldwide.
Mm-hmm.
But it would be sort of passively incorrect to just kind of throw that message out there to the working class, particularly in a country like the United States, where the working class generally has very deep illusions in the electoral process,
mm-hmm.
sort of the bourgeois democratic republic. And even, you know, in the bourgeois democratic parties, the capitalist class, i.e. the Republicans and Democrats. It's quite difficult, essentially, to make a break in the electoral sphere. But tactically speaking, we have nothing against it. as long as it's used in a correct way, in the sense to advance the program of the need for working class revolutionary organization and to take state power.
So do you think perhaps in that vein that the solution is to start at the local level, like Shama Sawant and Ty Moore have sort of already made kind of some inroads on that?
I don't know if you necessarily have to start at that level. It has a tendency to.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't say it's a stage that has to be gone through.
Okay.
It has to start at local levels in various big cities around the country, and then eventually there'll be sort of a committee meeting or a conference meeting to establish a federalized basis of some future organization, then maybe a national leadership committee. I don't think it has to go through these, you know, compartmentalized stages.
Mm-hmm.
But that's why we were very clear that the Labor Notes Conference and sort of in our sort of analyses of Swan in Seattle that we needed to sort of take advantage of her victory and social alternatives victories, as well as sort of the gatherings at Labor Notes to push as a national question and to say, like, how can we take advantage of the moment and start taking tiny steps or, you know, to developing a national organization or a workers' party? And there's no easy feat. It's just a matter of how can we tactically go about pushing the issue on a national level, because I do think that's a key aspect of what we're trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
I've always thought that electoral politics was a good bully pulpit for pushing revolutionary ideas.
Sure.
I even ran for Congress when I was 24 in the 3rd Congressional District of Wisconsin, which was the same district that Victor Berger was elected to Congress in 1910 and again in 1912.
So it was Milwaukee area?
The last socialist and only socialist that's ever been elected to Congress, out of Milwaukee, yes.
Right.
The birthplace of modern American socialism, mm-hmm. for all practical purposes.
Well, what about Bernie Sanders?
I have heard rumors that he is going to run for president, but David informed me today that he's supporting Israel against Palestine, so that is not good.
Well, there's a debate. Yeah, I was going to say that I asked that because there's kind of a debate about whether or not Bernie Sanders is still a socialist, because one time I think he was, but what do you think of that, Dan?
Absolutely not. I wouldn't consider him a socialist in any way.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, so, all right. So when you were at Labor Notes, what kind of reception were you getting from a lot of the people there? I mean, did you make some contacts, like, say, you know, with some rank-and-file people from other unions in other parts of the country? To put it another way, did you think you going to Labor Notes was were you pleased with going there? Do you think it was worth your time and stuff?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. We were quite surprised, honestly, at the reception.
Okay.
It was rather positive.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, of course, you know, relatively speaking, not all workers there shared the view or had, you know, a deep-seated interest in the political aspect of mm-hmm. working-class organization. But, many people, we had, you know, the resolution that we brought, many rank-and-filers signed it, presidents of union locals signed it, which we were rather pleasantly surprised to see.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was, you know, an excellent intervention.
Well, good.
To be honest with you, and I think it's if it didn't do anything, because obviously Labor Notes isn't a decision making or that conference doesn't decide anything. Nobody's bound by anything. It
right.
Wasn't put to a vote.
Mm-hmm.
But the reason why we wanted to do it was to sort of gauge to see what the rank and file of the trade unions thought about this aspect of complete political independence from the capitalist parties.
Mm-hmm.
Running. You know, forming this organization, running its own candidates, committed to class struggle, in a way that hasn't really ever existed in the history of the U.S. labor movement. U.S. working class never, I guess you could, the Socialist Party of the early 20th century,
mm-hmm.
you know, which had 125,000 members at one point, was like the best shot.
Mm-hmm.
That didn't really last. And you had various initiatives, like you said, through John Lewis and the CIO movement. And even the Labor Party of 1996 never really established complete independence from the Democrats or the capitalist class, anyway. So, you know, it was good to see that people agreed with that notion,
mm-hmm.
you know, however amount, that we needed this complete independence, not just sort of, you know, a vote-catching organization for Democrats of
mm-hmm.
left nature.
You know, I was surprised. That was the first Labor Notes I'd ever attended, and I was really surprised, pleasantly surprised, about how often I heard various people there use the word capitalist in a derogatory way. And when Kishama Sawant was there, she spoke at, I think, a couple different workshops and stuff. I mean, she was like a rock star. I mean, she had to have a couple people around her all the time just to kind of keep multitudes of people wanting to come up and meet her and stuff. So I think this indicates to me that there's a large segment of working people out there are just getting tired of the betrayals by both the Democratic Party and a lot of times their own union leadership, and are looking for something to make a real change.
Well, I think
that's entirely correct.
Okay, Jim?
Yeah, I think it's getting more and more difficult each day to be able to operate in the so-called bourgeois democracy that he said. You know, the only solution is revolution, but we have to fight for reforms even just to show that it's impossible to do anything but go all the way at this point. The bourgeois democratic revolution, Marx said, could only be accomplished by the proletariat in the final instance. This country can't even pass the Equal Rights Amendment for women. You know, it's depressing, but we have to be optimistic here, because I think the consensus is that of people, the polls show that the approval of Congress by the American people is only 7%, and I heard that that's actually lower than that.
Wow!
So there has to be a substitute, but how do you get on? You know, the bully pulpit. Mm-hmm. You know, and the NSA can't organize a revolution on the telephone or the computer.
You can, but you just have to be conscious, I guess, that they're listening, and you take the attitude of we're going to do it anyway, But Dan, listen, how could people find out, like listeners out there, find out more about your organization? Do you have like a website or a Facebook page?
Absolutely, you can visit our website at www.workerspower.net.
Okay.
And I would, as a compendium, I would also check out www.l5i.org.
Okay. Yeah, L55. What is that? I was kind of puzzled about what that meant.
It's an international organization which we have sympathies with.
Uh-huh.
It has the aim of establishing a new workers' international.
Ah, okay.
With lineages from the first, second, third, and fourth, and essentially to learn the lessons of the history of those struggles to build an international working class party, and to take what was revolutionary in all the phases of, because we do believe that all those internationals either collapse or politically cross the glass line at one point in time and are no longer either in existence or viable revolutionary organizations. So we stand in the lineage in the history of the revolutionary period of the Fourth International and seek to apply the gains made by Trotsky and that organization to a new international today.
Yes, go ahead, Jim.
Yeah, can I ask you what your relationship is, for example, to the international socialist organizations and some of the others, particularly the ISO?
I mean, it depends what you mean by relationship.
Well, I mean, are you working with them at all? Do you talk to them?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, okay.
I work with them in Philadelphia, and other members work with them in other cities across the country. And we actually just did an intervention at their international gathering, which is called socialism with the year. We did sort of a critical analysis of some of their electoral positions, particularly in New York State.
Okay.
With the Howie Hawkins campaign and running on the Green Party, we sort of had critical comments about that. So we're critical, but we work together in terms of practical efforts that support the working class when and where possible. But we don't let up on our criticism of them politically.
Okay, well that's great. I've been seeing this trend now for the last couple of years. It seems like that more and more organizations out there are being they see the common need and are starting to cooperate more and more. And that's really good to hear from you as well. So Dan, thank you so much for calling in. And you want to give that website again for the listeners?
Yes, it's www.workerspower.net.
Okay, well thanks again for calling in.
Thank you for having me.
Take care. Goodbye.
Right, bye bye.
Thank you.
while CEOs made giant salaries. What can we do? Occupy Wall Street.
Okay, that was the song. Let's see, what was that one?
Occupy Wall Street.
It was 99% blues.
Oh, 99%.
Yeah.
Blues.
So anyway, this is the World Labor Hour on the Listen Support Community Radio Station WFT in Champaign, Illinois, and we're back here. And Jim Iman, let's talk a little bit more about the Ukraine. Let's see. Right before our caller called in from actually Philadelphia, I thought it was New York City, but Philadelphia, we were talking about the Ukraine, about the one reporter who was arrested. He worked for RT Television.
Yeah, Graham Phillips. Mm-hmm. So we're glad that he's safe, but it's the right now the there's a journalism review gives the Ukraine the worst ratings. It's the least safe place to be a reporter in currently.
Wow.
More so than Syria, more so than Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
Now that's going a ways.
Indeed.
Several of them have been, I think there have been seven assassinations of journalists.
Wow. Okay. And so, yeah, of course, the corporate media is trying to spin this as Putin's is attempting to expand the Russian empire. And he's, you know, basically going into Ukraine and trying to take this territory and using Russian mercenaries. You know, it's funny, though, because the only mercenaries I heard about being in Ukraine were from basically being paid by our tax dollars, some group called Greystone mercenaries.
Okay. Yeah, well, Greystone is another one of Eric Prince's morph of
Blackwater.
Blackwater.
Okay.
That's what Greystone is.
Mm-hmm.
And, right, oh, I mean, they're trained assassins. Mm-hmm. These guys are good.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, the bombings. There's 250,000 people have had to leave the Lugansk and Donetsk.
Mm-hmm.
And the ones that stay there are fighting to the bitter end.
How come we're not, you know, it's funny because even the corporate media has been showing what's been going on in Gaza, you know, with the Israeli attacks and all the, you know, tremendous civilian lives lost, including those four boys, 9 to 13 years old, that were killed by Israeli gunboat. But nothing about this. That I've seen, anyway, in the corporate media, anyway.
Well, that's right. You've either got to find it on the internet or from RT.
Mm-hmm. So what do you think is the real reason here? Why is it that you think the State Department of the United States is spending all this money and all this time with Ukraine? Now, of course, maybe we go back a little bit. What precipitated this whole violent takedown of the elected government earlier this year about an International Monetary Fund deal, wasn't it?
Yeah, Yakovsky was the one who was overthrown, and you know it was a violent coup,
mm-hmm.
is what it was, democratically elected, and there was only like 7 or 8 months to go before the next election.
Mm-hmm.
They couldn't wait that long. Now the reason he rejected because they're poor and they're having a hard time. This is a very poor country to begin with,
mm-hmm.
and they wouldn't even be taken in. By the EU, they're so poor. They'd have to lend them so much money and everything else. And they were willing to lend them some money if, for example, the one thing I know is that they would cut government subsidies for gas,
mm-hmm.
oil, and some other things, which would impoverish the people even more.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So he was
neoliberal austerity economics on an already broken state.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that's why it was rejected.
Okay.
So then we get the fascists in there. Oh, they're going to fix the world just like Hitler.
Well,
make the trains run on time.
You know, of course there was there was a lot of people, I'm sure, in those crowds that weren't fascists. But it appeared, you know, from what I just saw in the coverage, is they were expecting being taken into the EU, that they'd become overnight the same standard of living as, say, Germany or Sweden, for instance. And, you know, of course, we know that that's not true because look what happened back in 1989 and through the 90s, you know, in Eastern Europe. You know, my wife's cousin still lives in Poland. I remember, you know, after she thought that they were going to be, and East Germany, too, that they were just going to become, you know, basically incorporated into that same standard of living with a social support network. Well, instead, within a month, half the country lost their job. Rents tripled and food prices quadrupled, you know, and this is what it is. I mean, you know, the capitalist class don't want middle class incomes of working people earning middle class incomes for two reasons. One, because it takes away profits from their pocket. And two, I think, and almost importantly, is political reasons. Because if people are fairly well off with earning a decent income, they've got more free time to politically organize, more free time to read and learn about what's going on. So they're a potential danger to the capitalist class out there. Would you agree with that? Or?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
They're dangerous, and especially if they want to be, you know, have some sort of a socialist Ukraine,
mm-hmm.
the Ukrainian people don't really want what's going on, a lot of them. Now they've banned the Communist Party, which had 2.5 million voters for the Ukrainian CP in the last election to get their delegates in. They've thrown all the delegates, you know, out of parliament and banned the party.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
That's a sizable number of people disenfranchised.
Yeah, yeah. That's right.
Yeah.
I mean, they are afraid of the Ukrainian people.
Mm-hmm. So why do you think the U.S. State Department's in there doing all this in Ukraine? I mean, do you think it's... it's almost looking like they're trying to do Cold War 2.0 here or something. And for different reasons, different contexts, but...
There definitely is a Cold War. You know, that's the new thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, it has to do with... power over resources in mm-hmm. the final instance.
Okay.
Now, Ukraine could be a rich country on its own. Mm-hmm. It has precious metals, and it's got a lot of coal, and it's got great agriculture. Mm-hmm. It was kind of like the breadbasket of Europe for a long time.
And it's got quite a bit of industrial infrastructure, too.
Yes.
Don't they? Okay.
All of these.
Mm-hmm.
And the most radical part of it, and the richest part, is the eastern part. That's being bombed.
Okay. All right. Now, I thought this was really bizarre. Sense. First, I mean, with that Malaysian airliner shot down.
Yeah.
In that basically was over 100 kilometers off course. Going into an area that had been declared a no-fly zone because of hostilities. And here, just not too long ago, a Malaysian airliner going down, you know, in the South China Sea or wherever. I mean, what's this with Malaysian airliners? I mean, well, is this a weird coincidence or what?
Well, it's tragic for the airlines, that's for sure. But we don't know. Mm-hmm. But what's happened is the stocks have just plummeted for Malaysian airlines. Yeah. They're going to have to change their brand. People aren't booking flights on their planes.
No, I wonder why. But anyway, it's interesting because they haven't, you know, of course, all the corporate media is automatically putting the blame on the separatists. You know, they're trying to defend themselves. But there's been no proof of this, that they were the ones that actually shot it down. I mean, it's conceivable, in my opinion, it's not like it's never happened before, is that maybe this was shot down by the Ukrainian authorities to try to provoke...
There is... This one is out. There was in the vicinity, there was a Ukrainian fighter.
Mm-hmm. Fighter plane? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Missiles
and stuff.
With missiles.
Mm-hmm.
This is not out of the question. So what they're going to finally conclude here, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But in any event, it was Kiev that gave them the go-ahead to go through that area.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
That we know for a fact.
Okay.
You know?
So, I mean, they were, at the very least, it looks like they were hoping this would happen, you know? This, of course, this is always, you know, any time a plane or a ship goes into a war zone, I mean, it's just being in a war zone, accidents happen. I mean, it's mistaking the commercial airliner or boat for an enemy ship or plane or whatever. But do you think the United States and some of Western Europe, because it seems like in Western Europe there's been a little bit of division. I mean, it seems like Germany's got a little bit of cold feet on this whole thing that's